When I was a teenager, a long, long time ago, I worked in a Christian bookshop on Saturdays, and it was quite possibly the best Saturday job going. My boss was a lovely man, and he allowed me to have all my friends to visit every Saturday during my working hours, and he would allow them to sit in his staff room and eat all his chocolate and drink all his tea, and he used to extend my lunch break so I could sit and chat with my friends. And it was a fantastic job. I loved it. Loads of them would come. Most of them weren't Christians, and they would just sit in the back room. It was the place to be. And the other great thing about it was he used to make me read a lot of the books in the bookshop so I could be confident in selling them. In all honesty, I don't think I sold an awful lot of them in the 5 years I worked there. I think I spent most of it in the staff room. But there was one particular book that always stood out to me. And it was, I can still remember it, it was called Too Busy Not to Pray by a man called Bill Hybels. I can still see it now. It had a white spine and had blue writing on the front. And I was really, really struck by the title, that there is nothing more important than making time for God. And at many moments of my life, I haven't actually lived that out. Sometimes I've pretty much declared myself too busy to pray. And then I've stopped, and I've remembered, and I've paused, and I've taken the time. The title of the book really influenced me when I was younger. Unfortunately, I was always too busy to read the actual book, so I've actually got no idea what the content was about at all. Hey-ho. But busyness is something that we have in common with each other. So many of us are so busy. We might be busy socially or at work or getting children to the endless activities they seem to have, preparing for meetings, preparing for guests, so many things in so many ways. And some people feel very guilty about their busyness, whereas others seem to thrive on it. I've heard it called a modern disease. And I think the story of Mary and Martha in Luke 10 offers some wisdom into our busyness. So I'd like us to read it together. There are some Bibles around on the tables, and feel free to grab one. If you don't own a Bible of your own, please feel free to make one of these your own and take it home with you. We're looking at Luke chapter 10, verses 38 to 42. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She came to him and asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." I think this is quite an interesting story for the author of Luke to actually include in his gospel at all. Why did he think it was fitting to include a story about a dinner party and a quarrel between two sisters? It's only four verses long. To be honest, it's not really much of a story. But I think we have to step back a bit and begin to understand the author of the gospel. If we understand his motivation, we might understand why the story's there. Throughout Luke's gospel, there are stories that reflect the idea that God is for everyone. God is for the Samaritan in Jesus' parable of loving your neighbour that Ben and David talked about a few weeks ago. Later on in Luke chapter 19, God is for Zacchaeus, the tax collector who made good choices after an encounter with Jesus. And also time and time again, God is for women, whom Luke has championed throughout the book. Women had little status in first century Palestine, and you might have heard that before. They were considered to be second-class citizens, pretty much akin to slaves. A widow or a spinster would be powerless in a male-dominated society. Indeed, a Jewish girl would receive no formal education outside of the home. She learned everything from her mother. Whereas the boys, they received formal education, some even up to the age of 18. A Jewish girl could not go and study and learn the scriptures. She learnt them at home, from her brothers, from her mother. To be a disciple and discipleship was not an option for a Jewish girl. So the fact that women are often mentioned as followers of Jesus is quite unusual. And throughout the gospel stories, Jesus is often seen talking with women. He's listening to them, allowing them to discover for themselves that he is their saviour too. Luke, the writer, places great emphasis on God's love for the poor, the tax collectors, sinners, women, Samaritans, Gentiles. The message is, love your neighbour, whomever that may be. Later on in the Gospel, in the story of Zacchaeus in chapter 19, we can understand the mission of Jesus as Luke understood it. He said, the Son of Man, Jesus, came to seek and save the lost. Considering the lowly status of women at this time, they're considered maybe to be lost. In the short story of a dinner party, Jesus shows that all can play their part in this mission. Let's look at the story a little bit more. It's a short story, 4 verses, but it has so much to tell us. Firstly, we have Martha welcoming Jesus into her home. Since it mentions it was her home, we can possibly assume that she was a widow, living with her younger sister Mary. If she'd been married, it wouldn't have been described as her home. In another gospel, she's mentioned with having a brother called Lazarus. But he's not mentioned here. And he must have been younger than Mary, in fact less than 13, because otherwise he would have come of age and he would have inherited the family home. So that means Martha is still quite young to have such a younger brother. Possibly she's not even 20 yet. So what we could be seeing here is a young widow with a younger brother and a single younger sister who's still in the home. Maybe she's not even 20. And for her to welcome 12 single men and Jesus into her home is a little bit unorthodox. In fact, it's quite a scandal. And as the plot unfolds, we see her younger sister, Mary, takes a place at the feet of Jesus and listens to his teaching. Now, I'm sure some of you, if you have teenage children, might have heard them use this verse as chore avoidance. Oh, I can't wash up. I want to be like Mary and pray and listen to Jesus. I don't want to be a Martha and do the washing up. It's quite a good one. Quite often when we do this story at school, the children at school get quite excited about this story, and you can see their minds ticking over, thinking, how can I use this for my own benefit to get out of things like detention and things like that? But poor Martha, I mean, she gets such a hard time. Every time I've heard people talk about this story, they talk about Martha as this terrible woman who just didn't get Jesus at all, and I don't think that's quite true. You see, poor Martha, her sister was causing a scandal. To sit at a rabbi's feet was the place for a man, not the place for a woman, not the place for a young, single woman especially. The place of a disciple, which is what to sit at the feet of a rabbi is a position only held by men in that society. And furthermore, she ought never have to been in that room in the first place. Men and women could only mix in the marital bedroom or in an open play space, but definitely not within the home. Her place should have been backstage, in the kitchen or the private quarters where all the other women belonged. She was breaking so many cultural taboos, and Jesus didn't seem to mind. In fact, he accepted her position of a disciple. And then Martha is distracted by all the preparations that have to be made. Sometimes you sort of think, yes, she's very distracted, but I think I would be too. If somebody suddenly said to me, 13 people are coming to your house for dinner, I'd be a bit distracted too. About the fact that I've probably got no food in the house. My house is, Alex is laughing, absolutely generally a tip. And I'll have to tidy it up somehow. And I'd panic, and I know I would. And I would rush home, and I would try and get there before everybody else to tidy it up and get the food ready. And I'd be in the kitchen, and everyone would be in the front room, and I'd be panicking. So I can sort of understand, really, where Martha's coming from. So she's trying to get the food ready. And she's really worried about her younger sister's very inappropriate behaviour. And she wants to serve Jesus the best. She wants to give Jesus the very best she can. She loves him as her friend. She wants to honour him through her service to him, as any good host would. And I've always found it interesting that Martha asks Jesus if he did not care that she was serving alone. Did she mean, do you not care that I'm being left to do everything by myself? Or did she mean, do you not care that my sister has left me to sit with you? Think of the scandal. The first implies that she cares only for herself and her hardship. The second implies that she is worried by all that needs to be done to serve their guests, and also worried by the inappropriate behaviour of her sister. Now, I think she's concerned a little bit by the latter, because it could get both her sister and Jesus into quite a lot of trouble. And Jesus answers, Martha, "Martha, you are anxious and troubled by many things." He must know her quite well to speak in such a fond manner, to say her name in such a way. I guess he likes her, and he knows her to be the type of person who likes to get everything right, just right. It shows her love for others, maybe. If you've ever read the Love Languages book by a guy called Gary Chapman, you could probably guess that her love language would be acts of service. She shows her care for others by serving them. Maybe that's what she was doing for Jesus. And yet, even though Jesus obviously loves Martha and understands her and knows where she's coming from, he still says that Mary has chosen what is better, even though he knows it will hurt Martha. Some Bible translations says that Mary has chosen the better portion. I really like that word, portion. And it comes up a lot. And Mary would have recognized that word from in the Psalms, the songs the Jewish people sang to praise God. It would have come up in her history of just hearing the songs that were sung at home and at the festivals in their family home. As an example, in Psalm 73, it says, "My heart and my flesh may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." In Psalm 119, the writer says, "You are my portion, O Lord. I have promised to obey your words." The word portion here has connotations of God being enough, of God being enough to fulfill every need, and that all that matters is having fellowship with God. Indeed, at the time, it would have been understood in that way. God was their portion. He was complete. He was enough for them. And by acknowledging that God is our source for everything, that fellowship with him is where everything makes sense. We have all we need. Everything comes from that place of being with God. Mary knows this, and she has chosen fellowship, time with Jesus. And by sitting at his feet, she's responding to that call to be a disciple of Jesus. She's there to spend time with him, to spend time with her Lord and to learn, no matter what the consequences, no matter how great the scandal of her being there. Jesus, who came to seek and save the lost, who came to show God's love to everyone, he accepts her position, even though she's a woman and ought not to have been there in the first place. I wonder, when I read this story, what was Jesus teaching about? Because all it says is Jesus was teaching. And I'd love to know what he was teaching about. Previously in the chapter, he has sent out the 72, or 70, if you want to argue how many numbers there are. He sent out a large number of disciples to go and preach and heal and make whole. And they come back with amazing stories of what God has done. And Alex Griffin's going to talk about that in a couple of weeks. And then he tells this amazing parable, the parable of the Good Samaritan, where people learn to love their neighbor. What came next? Whatever it is, it's going to be great. Jesus has just sent out all these people for amazing things. He's just told this amazing parable. Whatever comes next is going to be great teaching, and Mary's taking full advantage of it. She's there to learn. She's there to learn from this amazing storyteller. And in her place at his feet, she's learning how to be a disciple, how to love others, how to act, and clearly, as she listens, how to worship Jesus. Now, often her position in theology is painted as a contemplative model as opposed to Martha's practical and distracted model. But I think there's a little bit more going on here. I don't think it's quite so simple. In her taking on the role of a disciple, Mary's being equipped for action. She's being filled with learning and she's being inspired to worship. And there is a call through this passage for us to come to this place. And I see three areas of calling in this passage for us. As we sit at the feet of Jesus, we are called to action with him. We learn about him and we worship him. The disciples were sent out with a mission, and so are we. We're called to action. It may be seen in service in the morning at weekly worship. You might serve on a rota for Vineyard Kids. You might go out on the streets on a Saturday morning and serve the homeless by feeding them and giving them hot coffee or tea. You might meet your neighbours, build bridges into communities that David's been talking about recently. I've been reading a book called Making Life Work, which again is by the same guys before, Bill Hybels, and this time I've actually read it, not just the title. And I was moved by God when I read in it how we should be people of peace in the places where we go, and it set me thinking and it spurred me to action. Just before Christmas, I had a rather unpleasant argument with a colleague from work in a rather public place in the school staff room. It played out in front of quite a large number of people, and it was very, very unpleasant. And it got left unresolved. Everything went back to normal. We share an office, me and my colleague, and it's a very small office. And everything just went back to normal. It sort of got swept under the carpet, and we were being very polite, very kind to each other, laughing at each other's jokes. Everything outwardly was very fine. But every time I saw her, I felt wrong. The fault had actually not been mine to start with. However, I knew that the unresolved conflict was as much my responsibility as it was hers. And I also knew that I was a Christian and she wasn't, and that God was calling me to do something. I sat at the feet of Jesus, and I remember I asked him to disciple me and said, what should I do? And I realized I had to take action. So I approached this colleague at work, I think it was last week, and I made my peace. I asked her to forgive me and just said, let's clear the air. She was so visibly shocked that I was a bit staggered myself. She explained to me the background as to why we'd had this argument, and I felt I understood her a lot better. And I felt God's kingdom broke in a little bit more that day because she was so shocked that I cared enough to clear the air, because I could have just left it swept under the carpet as most people did. I was really quite frightened about doing it. She's quite a scary lady. You know the dragons you have in school? She's one of those. And she was really quite a scary lady. And she was so soft when I apologised to her, and I just felt God's blessing upon that. And it wasn't half as scary as I thought it would be. See, we need to take action for Jesus in the world around us. It might be resolving a conflict like I had to at work. Perhaps inviting round those neighbours you've always wanted to get to know better. I was really struck last week. Somebody was talking about how when there was heavy snow, some people in our community had been looking for houses that had no footprints outside them. Because in the 3 or 4 weeks of snow we had, the no footprints would imply that somebody hadn't been out of their house in a long time and nobody had been in. Perhaps that was an elderly person living there, or perhaps a very lonely person. And what could we as a community do to help these people in these homes? I have a very good friend at work who has no belief in God, and we are good friends and we don't argue. And Nick and I have been praying for her and her husband for over a year now. We've invited them to church events. They've been on nice long walks with us. They've met quite a lot of people in our church community. They came to the Alpha launch in town, which they said was very interesting. And they have no real desire to get to know Jesus, but they love hearing us talk about it, so we do a lot. We always offer to pray for them. They're not always overly accepting, but whenever they say things like, oh, this is going on and it's a bit stressful, we always reply with, we'll pray for that for you. And over time, they've got used to us doing it. And when they were selling their house a few months ago, they had many stressful disappointments. And so my friend challenged me to pray for a cash buyer that afternoon, which was quite a terrifying challenge. And I did explain to her, you know, God's not a slot machine. You know, you can't just put in hoping that was my get out clause, because I was thinking this is a bit scary. So I did. I said, OK, well, I'll pray. We'll see what happens. And I did. And it happened. And they got a cash buyer that afternoon. And I tried not to look as gobsmacked as I was. But it really did happen. It was amazing. And anyway, life carried on, and last week she texted me and asked me to do that, to quote, magic praying thing you do. I think she slightly doesn't understand. For a pregnant friend of hers who was having a really difficult labour. She'd been in labour, I think, for 3 days, which sounded horrific to me. And so I prayed, and I had a picture of what was causing the difficulty in the labour, so I prayed about that because I thought that was a good thing to do. And then I shared this with her afterwards, said, you know, I prayed and this is what I saw, because I've talked to her a bit before about having pictures from God and how that works. And she was just like, oh, that's exactly it. And she went, wow, your God's really clever. I was like, yeah, he is, yeah. More than you'd know. And it was just brilliant. And she's coming that little bit step closer to Jesus. And, you know, from being at a place at the feet of Jesus, we begin to understand his heart for the lost. And then we get inspired to take risks and to take action. And I really have been with her, and I've taken some fairly silly risks with her, and they're paying off most of the time. And as we sit at the feet of Jesus, like Mary did, we worship him and we're called to a place of learning. It might be studying the Bible more intentionally. It might be reading good books. It might be enrolling on one of the kingdom courses that will be happening in the community in February. We can learn more about the Jesus that we follow. Our learning might happen outside of devotional times, during our daily walk. God may speak to us through the actions and the experience of others. When that happens, do we assume a position of learning at the feet of Jesus when we hear and we see the wisdom of others? Are we teachable? A while ago, in Vineyard Kids, Sunday morning at weekly worship, my daughter Grace was learning about looking after her money. And Grace is seven. She's amazing, by the way. And she came home with this money box that she's decorated beautifully pink. And it had three rows in it, and it's called the Spend, Save, and Give box. And at the time, we were saving up for a Nintendo Wii as a family because the kids wanted one, and Nick and I thought it would be really good if they saved up for one. That means hassling their grandparents, rather than us just paying for one straight out. So we had a chart on the wall, and we coloured in the thermometer like they do, and we worked our way up this chart, and they did really, really, really well. I was very impressed. And when Grace brought this home, we talked about it, and we were inspired. And Grace and Emily decided, Grace is seven, Emily's five, they decided to raise a bit extra because they were inspired by the save and give part. So they saved extra money. And before they spent their money buying the Nintendo Wii, they decided they would give the extra away. And they were sort of, in their own way, tithing, I suppose. And Grace chose to give her bit to the big issue man in Chapel Allerton because she likes to take him coffee. And Emily sent hers to a little girl we sponsor in India. She bought something for their community. And Nick and I were just so amazed by them because in their incredibly innocent way, they taught us a lot about what it means to sit at the feet of Jesus and learn. Because they sat there and said, well, it says spend, save and give. Well, that's what we'll do then. And it was so simple to them, and we learnt a lot through that. That day, when they inspired us, we sat at the feet of Jesus, and as a family, we learnt a very big message about our money. Finally, as we sit at the feet of Jesus, we're called to a place of worship. Everything we learn, all our actions are bought as worship, as is our adoration and praise. We bring our lives as an offering to God, and we surrender all to him. A disciple loves their master, just like Mary was doing to Jesus. She loved him. And it's about putting Jesus first. There will always be things to do. And I'm not going to say busyness is wrong, stop doing everything, just be in God's presence. God's presence goes with us as we go and do. We need to get our focus right, and then everything we do flows out of that. If we approach all we do with the disciple's heart, that means spending time in his presence first, and then we do all with Jesus. We live our lives alongside him, seeing his peace, his grace, his mercy, and his compassion woven into the way that we live. I think the disciples at the time of Jesus must have lived really, really busy lives, sometimes very difficult lives. They dropped everything to follow Jesus. They had no home of their own. And they followed him around, learning from him, being confused by his stories, but understanding them a bit more later. Hearing him say things that sort of alluded to his death, which worried them, they didn't quite get at the time. Many of them went on to be martyrs. They died for their faith at the early church. And in their busy, sometimes difficult lives, they were filled with passion and joy because of who they were doing it for and because it came from a place of sitting at the feet of Jesus first. I don't think we should do things because they have to be done. I think we do them because Jesus calls us to do them. Because we're doing it with Jesus, and he loves to walk alongside us as we act, as we learn, and as we worship him. A few times at weekly worship, Nick has shown a clip that I think shows just how linked worship is with our daily lives. And as disciples, we're learning to follow Jesus as he sends us out. It all begins from being at his feet. An attitude of worship, an attitude of teachability, an attitude of willingness to go and act as we're called, to act upon what we've heard. So I'd like us just to look at that clip again. The action of Mary sitting at Jesus' feet, being a disciple, was a risk that crossed all social and cultural boundaries. In allowing it, or even encouraging it, Jesus was affirming her place as a disciple. And we're encouraged to do the same. In fact, you could say it's the sign of mature faith is living out this discipleship of Jesus, bringing together learning, action, and worship in everything we do. For me, these four verses this short story are not a simple story to illustrate that contemplative worship is better than practical service, only that all should come from a place of fellowship with Jesus. I assume Jesus and his disciples still ate the food prepared for them by Martha. She was correct in her role as host. However, she missed the point of Jesus' presence at the meal. Discipleship at the feet of Jesus encourages us to learn, to listen, to act and worship, and all flow naturally from a place of fellowship with him.